Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're taking you to school. And we've got some music lessons for you coming from some unpredictable sources. And our producer, Daisy Rosario, is here to help us today on our musical journey. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Maria. So excited.
So excited because we have something pretty unexpected coming up.
Unexpected not just for the show, but unexpected when it happened.
All right, so here's the story. The story was we were at the NPR Bureau here in New York, and we found out that Bill Cosby was going to be coming in to do an interview for Morning Edition. And I said, oh my God, we've got to interview Bill Cosby on Latino USA. And then he said yes.
And he said yes because part of our excitement was that you had this great story of seeing him live over the years, and I'm a huge fan of his having grown up on his comedy and on The Cosby Show itself, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. But when we approached him about this idea of wanting to talk to him specifically about salsa, he lit up.
Oh, my God. I remember when we had him on the phone, he was like, of course I want to come and talk with you. Absolutely. And I was like, I can't believe that this man who I couldn't, you know, I've interviewed hundreds upon hundreds of people. He's the only one, Daisy, who I really could not bring myself to call him Bill. I was like, Mr. Cosby.
Something about it just happens in his presence, because he didn't ask us to do that, but
no,
we both did
all.
It.
It was like Mr. Cosby. And the truth is, Daisy, that I had, yes, this very special relationship with Bill Cosby as, you know, a young Mexican kid growing up on the south side of Chicago in the 1960s. You know, here's this voice that made me feel like, I don't know, like I got the jokes, like he understood me. But then once I got to New York, I had this whole kind of reality with my Latina identity. And, well, I end up seeing Bill Cosby in a kind of strange and unpredictable way.
Yeah, I love this story.
Guajira, vacila mi guajira.
So, Mr. Cosby, I don't know if I told you this, but after those times of watching you as a young person, as a child, you know, through my teen years and college. Actually, it was in the middle of college. I was doing a radio show here in New York City on WKCR, Columbia University radio station. And I would do a show every Wednesday night called Nueva Canción y Demás. It was a Latin American music show. We played salsa, Afro-Cuban, but that was not the only thing we played. But as a result of having this radio show, I got tickets for every Monday night at the Village Gate. Salsa Meets Jazz, one of the most amazing concert series, I think, in the world.
Yes.
Top jazz musicians, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, you know, anyone else would be on stage, yes, with top salsa musicians. Tito, yes, Puente, Eddie Palmieri.
Yes.
I would be dancing, usually, and then I'd see you arrive. Kind of in the, you know, just before the show was going to start up, you'd walk by, everybody would be busy talking to each other. And
in those days, you could smoke the cigarro.
Everybody was smoking cigarros. And you'd walk by, and then the next thing that would happen would be that you would be on stage in the corner with your cowbell.
Yes.
And I was like, that's Bill. And they never called you out.
No.
They were not like, and Mr. Cosby has joined us.
Yes.
What was that about?
It was about, I'm a nationally known celebrity on big time variety shows, The Tonight Show, et cetera, et cetera. And the musicians playing this style of music are not. And I wanted to bring my presence there to say that if someone sees this, they say, well, hey, this is Bill Cosby up there with so-and-so. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. You know, this must be for real, the music, to acknowledge my appreciation of who they are, whether they're on national TV or not.
Why did you want to do that, though? I mean, what was it about? That's a beautiful statement, and I think everyone who saw you there knew that.
But I wanted to do it because that music combined with the jazz, there was a time when it was on TV. TV was black and white then, but it was on TV. It was being broadcast on the crystal sets across this United States of America, coming from Cuba or and Puerto Rico. This music combined with the high recognized Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Sonny Rollins. Those nights at the Village Gate, I wish the people could see those nights. I mean, there is nothing to anything I've ever seen. The dancing, to the laughter, the happiness.
The funny thing about Bill Cosby's stand-up is that he always did it sitting down and in the form of the story.
I love that.
So, you know, you say stand-up, but really, you picture him, he's always in a chair. And I love this next bit where you spoke to him because it reminds me of his stand-up. It just, the way he even begins talking about it, everything he said, you know, he's used to doing this very story presentation version. So I think this whole thing is really fun.
It's all about story with Mr. Cosby. So here's Bill Cosby talking about the Lone Ranger.
So I'm a kid living with my mother. My father comes and goes as she let him. I'm listening to the radio. One of my favorites on the radio. Later to go on to TV. Later to go on and be in the theaters in black and white. In comic books, The Masked Man and his companion, Tonto.
There, just like others. That's good. Only you, Tonto, know I'm alive. To the world, I'll be buried here, beside my brother and my friends, forever.
You all alone now, last man. You are a Lone Ranger.
Yes, Tonto, I am a Lone Ranger.
Kemosabe.
Now, there's nobody that I know of in the Richard Allen Projects in North Philadelphia who speaks Spanish. So nobody is saying, nobody in the world of Bill Cosby going to school, coming home, going to church on
this
Sunday.
This is Philadelphia 1940s?
Born 1937. I stayed there until I was 14. Nobody in Spanish says to me, Tonto means stupid.
All right, Tonto. You'll be a lot of help. We'll ride together.
Me glad, Kemosabe. Me fight good for you.
Until Jonathan Winters.
He was the one?
Yes.
No kidding.
Jonathan Winters called me one day, and we were just talking. And he said, you know, the Lone Rangers are racist. So I said, well, what happened? He said he keeps calling the Native American guy stupid. I said, no, I didn't hear it. He says his name, they gave him a name, Tonto. In Spanish, that means stupid. Well, Jonathan was heavily Cherokee.
Oh, of course. Oh, my God.
Now, wait a minute. Here's the beautiful story. So I remember that, and I'm doing the Huxtables, and there's a fellow, I think he's Puerto Rican, and we were just talking on the set waiting for something, and so I brought this up. And while he was moving his camera, he said, yeah, I knew that. I said, well, what? And he told me he's Puerto Rican. And so I said, but I said, why is it nobody in the world? I mean, this thing goes out over the radio, the world. Why is it no Spanish groups are yelling and saying something. And there was a silence. And then he said to me, but Mr. Cosby, my father broke this down to me. So I said, what? He said, Tonto is stupid. I said, yeah, okay. He said, no, no, wait a minute. What did Tonto call the Lone Ranger? So I said, Kimo Sabe. He said, that's right. I said, so what's wrong with that? He said, my father said, there is no Native American sentence or name Kimo Sabe. So I said, well, it's got to be. He said, no. He said, but my father said, if you go Spanish and you do sounds like, he said, there's a word, who?
Quién?
Mo, he said, sounds like, and then he said, no.
¿Quién no sabe?
He said, it means he who knows nothing.
¿Quién no sabe?
So he said,
Kimo Sabe, ¿quién no sabe?
Yes. So he said, these two guys are called. I said, well, who are the writers doing this, man? Either these guys are the hippest people, and they're just laughing their way for a guy named, well, good morning, stupid. So yeah, he who knows nothing.
Welcome back to a very special Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking music lessons with Bill Cosby. And wherever there is Bill Cosby, there seems to be salsa. So I asked him about it. Anybody who's watched your television shows, they know that you had salsa on The Cosby Show.
Yeah.
You changed the theme song.
Yes.
To become a Latin theme song.
Sure. For that year.
Okay,
yes.
For that year. Same thing with your Comedy Central special. You come out with salsa. For you, this is a music, because you could come out with jazz. I mean, jazz is on my radio station all the time. For you, it's as if salsa is the music of your times.
Yes.
Is it?
It's forever. It's forever because it combines the free with for instance, when you count 1, 2, 3, 4, this music can start, the rhythm can start, and from that point there's a feeling. So when that's set, now comes the piano, the chords, the bass, the chords, the piano. And the music never lets you down. I mean, who really can turn down that music in any tempo?
It's so true. Music never lets you down. Isn't that true, Daisy?
It is very much true.
Joining me in the studio today is Daisy Rosario, one of our producers here at Latino USA, who was a part of this very amazing interview we did with Bill Cosby. So this interview, Daisy, gave us a whole lot of ideas.
Oh, that's right. I started thinking of these musicians that Mr. Cosby was talking about and hearing them in my house growing up with my family. And it made me realize that I should know a lot more. But I want to be really clear before we start talking about this, if you'll let me. This is not in any way a real, you know, thorough overview of the history of salsa. It is not that. So if you are a salsa historian, don't get mad at me. This is just us looking at some of what Mr. Cosby mentioned because it brought it into our minds as well.
Okay, the truth is that you may not know a lot about salsa, and then, of course, there are our salsa historians, yes, who are very particular, but there is one artist who we absolutely had to talk about with Mr. Cosby, and that is the one and only King, El Rey Tito Puente.
Mr. Cosby and Tito Puente were friends. Mr. Cosby clearly has a real admiration for him. Here's another thought that Mr. Cosby had about those nights at Salsa Meets Jazz.
When Tito would come and I would look at him, I knew that he was going to, he's a teacher. And that's what I wanted to really segue to, because that music and the men in it, they never stop teaching.
Mr. Cosby isn't the only person who thinks of Puente as a teacher.
Just being around him, you learn through osmosis. You know, you absolutely ingested everything that he had to say, and he did it in a way that didn't feel like he was teaching you a lesson, but rather he was just sharing something that he loved, sharing his passion.
This is Rebecca Mullion. She's a pianist and an educator, and she played with Puente. And the way that they met was really awesome.
The time that I met him, I was actually playing with a Pete Escovedo orchestra. And we opened for Puente's band at the Galleria Design Center as part of a Brazilian carnival celebration. He came up to me after our set and he made a comment about my playing that interested me, because he heard something in my playing that I hadn't known myself. And he heard that I had a sort of a jazz sensibility, even though I was playing more of a fusion, you know, Latin music with different things like funk and soul.
Mullion had grown up on Puente's music. She was a big fan. And here he was coming up to her, complimenting her music, you know, and it didn't stop there.
He asked me to record with him on one song on one of his albums. And that led to a couple of other recording sessions. And fast forward to the late 80s, and he wanted me to do an arrangement of a Brazilian composer's piece for his upcoming albums. And so that was certainly thrilling, let alone, you know, here was a person who quickly became a real mentor to me.
This was a big deal. And not just because it was a great experience for her, but because
there are not that many women in Latin jazz or salsa music who have an opportunity to compose an original piece of music or arrange anything for somebody like Puente, let alone to be taken seriously. It's a very male-dominated industry, and that's just kind of how the cards were dealt.
Which made it all the more surprising that he was asking her to create this for him.
I was flabbergasted, and of course I said yes without even hesitating. And that moment of bringing my original piece into the studio with all these, you know, tough New York dudes, and having them completely, you know, embrace the piece and having it swing, you know, in that recording studio, was probably one of the biggest thrills. So just that notion that somebody like that could and would advocate for younger and lesser known, you know, artists out there. It says a lot about his personality, the kind of person he was.
Tito got tired of giving an autograph, he would tell you, cool it, I gotta go. And people would be, taken aback and say, Tito Puente just told me to shut up and get away from me.
Joe Conzo Sr. is a music historian. He grew up with Puente's wife, Margie, and later he and Tito became friends. Great friends, actually.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, Margie would tell you, I would call the house, and depending on the mood she was in, she'd say, Tito, your husband's on the phone. Or Tito, your wife's on the phone.
Conzo was there for many of Puente's adventures, even meeting Bill Cosby along the way. And from what Conzo says, it sounds like Puente and Cosby had a lot in common. Conzo says this about Puente.
The guy was very humble, like Bill Cosby, no bodyguards. He was his own bodyguard. He was a street guy. And Bill was the same way. People say, Bill didn't have a bodyguard. No.
Okay, so Puente's a good guy. People love him. But what makes him a brilliant musician? One answer is that he took an instrument, the timbales, and he completely changed the way that people thought about that instrument.
he took this instrument, the Cuban timbales, which historically had been played in a more background supporting character kind of role. And in most Cuban bands, very traditional Cuban bands, the timbales player typically sat down. There were, of course, Cuban musicians who stood up and played the instrument. But what happened in the transformation of that instrument coming to New York and being part of the Latin orchestras there was that what Puente did was he took on the role very much like Gene Krupa did for jazz drumming, in giving the drummer a front, you know, a front row seat, if you will, and putting them in the spotlight. And by virtue of the fact that Puente did for the timbales what Gene Krupa did for jazz drumming, suddenly the dynamic in the East Coast was turned upside down in a wonderful way. You know, suddenly you have a drummer leading the band in the front, as opposed to being in the back. And so that set a new paradigm.
Tito Puente became, in a way, the face of this music.
People talk about, and I'm not taking anything away from Celia Cruz or Gloria Estefan. Tito opened the doors for all these people. He opened the doors for all these people because they wanted more besides Tito, and this happened.
But being the king wasn't easy. Here's NPR's Felix Contreras. He's the host of a great music podcast called Alt Latino.
For me as a journalist and as a part-time musician and as someone who has worked with Tito Puente, bringing him to schools to teach younger children and stuff, I immediately think of how hard he worked to maintain that title and what he had to do to get there and just to keep it going.
But if you ask Mr. Cosby, Tito Puente may have worked too hard.
I think Tito would still be alive if he had given himself or could give himself a rest time. And he was always with the humor. He was up, and somebody would come in, and I would look, and I knew that Tito did not know this person. And the person just wanted to be in the presence of the king. And they would make up something, and Tito would then begin to teach.
So when we were talking to Mr. Bill Cosby, he mentioned a lot of other musicians, and they came up throughout our conversation. But there was one musician that I actually hadn't thought about in a while, but of course, who I grew up listening to. And Bill Cosby loved this guy.
Yeah, I did not know about this man before I started working on this episode, but I love his work now.
A fellow with an odd spelling last name. Jader.
I think that I remember seeing that as a kid, and I was like, it's true, what a weird Jader.
Right. And especially when the letter J in Spanish is pronounced right.
You know, Rosa.
Right. So you have a T that's silent and a J, but his name is Jader.
Jazz fans already know that we're talking about Cal Jader. The T is silent. But if you didn't know, here's Felix Contreras again to explain.
Having grown up on the West Coast, for me, Cal Jader is in the same league with Puente and Machito and all of the other greats, all the big names, all the pioneers, because he was from San Francisco. And I had a chance to interview him in the late 70s for Radio Bilingue when I was doing programs for them. And, you know, he told his story in a way that helped me understand the connection between jazz and Afro-Cuban music when that was happening in the late 40s, early 50s, because he was part of that scene and he got to witness that scene. Cal Jader is a good example of how those two musics intermingle together musically and physically, too, because he told me this story about how with one of his first trips to New York, he had some guys in his band. He said, hey, we're playing on 52nd Street, but right around the corner over here is the Palladium Ballroom. You got to come check out some of these bands. And he went over there and he heard Puente and Machito and Tito Rodriguez and all of these great bands. And that turned him on to something he was already curious about. So he went back to California and put together his own thing. And he created his own, what I think is definitive small band Latin jazz, because he had a feel for it.
Okay, so again, this is not an overview of all the history of this music. This is just a few people that Bill Cosby brought up that we wanted to learn a little bit more about. That said, one of the names that came up the most and that we have to talk about is Mongo Santamaría. You know who loves Mongo Santamaría?
Oh, Mongo.
Felix Contreras does.
Mongo is many things to me. As a musician, as a music fan, as a conga player, because I play congas, I'm nowhere close to even. I have what's called what I consider a humble talent. Okay, but I like to play. He has definitive tone, and he has definitive style, and he has a definitive way. Everybody that plays emulates what he did. It's simple. It's clean, it's strong, it's creative, and that tone to die for on whatever instrument he picked up to play. You know, his grandfather was a former slave. He was immersed in Cuba, in the whole Afro-Cuban culture and tradition, and he carried that with him. So as an Afro-Cuban musician in the late 50s and into the early 60s a little bit, you know, he was playing straight-ahead Afro-Cuban music. But then, when he started mixing Afro-Cuban with early 60s, mid-60s soul and R&B, by playing Watermelon Man, by playing Pussycat, by playing all these other tunes that he had back then, to me, he connected two strands of the African diaspora by bringing in Afro-Cuban and African-American and meshing it in a way that you could not stop dancing. It was a perfect prism, a perfect combination of having those two things, and it all goes back to Africa.
So when I was talking to Mr. Cosby, you know, we kept talking about, you know, salsa. But the thing is that people don't really realize that salsa was a name that was created for this music. And actually, of course, Daisy, we know that naming this music salsa is just plain wrong.
That's right. I mean, look, we talked about Tito Puente, Cal Jader, Mongo Santamaría. We've been saying jazz, Afro-Cuban. So what is it? I asked our guests. I asked Felix. I asked Joe Conzo Sr. and Rebecca Moleon. What is salsa?
How much time do you have? You know, it's one of the long-running debates within the Latin community, the Latin music community, about the whole thing of salsa and what it means and what it doesn't mean.
People resent that I fight because of that word salsa. Salsa is when I go to your house and you cook for me. You make me rice and beans.
This is a true or false question that I ask my students in the Music of Latin America course that I teach in community college. True or false, salsa is not a rhythm. And they have to answer true. Because it is not a rhythm. It's a metaphor. It's a wonderful metaphor for a Cuban-based music that was largely performed and upheld and celebrated by Puerto Ricans in New York that has a mixture of jazz. So salsa was a very convenient term, a way of describing a music that had certainly a tropical Latin flavor. And it happened to be played a lot by Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and Cubans. But it has this inclusion of jazz, so there's a sort of fusion aspect to it.
Initially, I remember seeing Tito Puente, and he was like, you know what? We don't play salsa. We don't play rice. We don't play beans, you know? That's a food. You put salsa on your food. We play huaracha. We play mambo. We play cha-cha-cha. We play Afro-Cuban music. You know, he would do his whole shtick from there. But eventually, he embraced the term.
And it makes it easier for the Anglos to pronounce instead of saying guaguancó or guaracha or guajira, salsa. Let's go dance salsa. Let's go do salsa.
But it has created in its wake this huge divide, this ongoing controversy and argument about whether or not you should call it salsa.
so much history and so many wonderful stories to hear about all of these legendary people and their art. When we continue on our special Latino USA, we're going to talk about how Mr. Bill Cosby's work has affected us personally.
And not just us.
That's right. Coming up after the break, as Music Lessons with Bill Cosby continues on Latino USA. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So part of the reason why we wanted to talk to Mr. Bill Cosby was that, I mean, the truth is, Daisy, we both grew up with his work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's pretty amazing that multiple generations have grown up with his work now.
So I remember seeing him, again, as a young kid. You know, this was the height of the civil rights era in our country. And here was this amazing comedian coming into my home, home of Mexican immigrants, and telling these jokes. And I don't know, making us feel like we were part of this country, like we were family. That's my first reaction to Bill Cosby, is my dad, with his thick Mexican accent, able to understand the jokes that Bill Cosby was saying, and that we were like, oh, yeah, we get it. I think we are a little bit American. We're getting the jokes.
And for my family, I mean, my mother, myself, my grandmother, and my grandfather all sitting down together, and my aunt watching as a family, you know, those are some of my favorite memories. And my grandfather would always repeat the jokes, you know? He was somebody who would repeat the jokes. There's a famous episode that people know now because apparently a young Alicia Keys was on it, where it's a sleepover party and he's playing with all of Rudy's friends. And my grandfather would reenact that when friends would come over. And so for us, it was just so, so, so special. But it was also special because we saw people that looked like us on it. I asked Felix Contreras about the idea of representation, of seeing Latinos on The Cosby Show, and if that's something he thinks of when he thinks of Mr. Cosby.
No doubt. Absolutely. I mean, I've always wanted to shake his hand and thank him for doing things like that. He had Sonia Braga on.
Yes.
You have seen a lot of babies. Uh-huh. But tell me the truth. Isn't Gabriella the most beautiful baby you ever seen in your life?
Yes, but please don't tell Mrs. Huxtable I said that.
He had Tito Puente, you know, on NBC Primetime Thursday night when NBC was the deal, was the real deal, the big deal. For people who pay attention to representation issues in television, it doesn't get any better than that. And it really hasn't since then. Because I don't know that Tito Puente was on a primetime television show since then. You know, he moved things forward in a big way, and he made a major contribution to spreading the word about who these musicians are, and in the process, explaining their contribution to the overall culture here in the United States. Because it's not, you know, the Latin world and everybody else. In Bill Cosby's perspective, it's all one society. It's all one music. It's all... we're all one group of people, and we all like different types of music. And I think that's what his show did. So, yeah, hats off to Mr. Cosby for doing that, because for me personally, that was a huge deal, a very big deal.
You know, being the age that I am, I'm in my early 30s now, so I was, you know, a little kid in the 80s when The Cosby Show was just starting, when it was at its peak. And I remember that was already a show that my family sat down and watched together every Thursday. And then when Tito Puente popped up, it was like, wait, but this is a person that we talk about in my house, not just the other people that we know of that I hear about at school or I hear other kids talk about. This is a person, Tito Puente is a person that my family talks about. And that was so special to me to see that on that show, that moment of that recognition, of that similarity of, you know, even just hearing, you know, in another episode when Claire does speak Spanish, it really was very important to me personally as well. Absolutely.
There's nobody there, dear.
The Cosby Show was really just, I want to say it was like a one-of-a-kind opportunity for a one-of-a-kind individual to spread his message. I mean, he had a platform, and he had a very big platform, and he worked hard, again, for that platform. I mean, I used to watch him going back to I Spy, you know, I mean, when he was young, or when he had his first Cosby Show, when Quincy Jones did the soundtrack for that in the 60s. He worked hard to get to that point where he is on NBC on Thursday night and he's able to expand and promote his own worldview, a view that many of us of different ages appreciated, endorsed, support, and just soaked it in. And just sort of like wrapped it around us like a shawl, like a flag, like this multicolored flag. Like, yeah, we're all part of the same group. We think alike. And it feels very, very hip to feel that way.
And Felix is so right. You know, I always think of the episode with Tito Puente on.
Ladies and gentlemen, even though Roscoe isn't with us, wherever he is, I'm sure he's smiling, because we have here tonight all the original members of the Jazz Caravan.
Oh my God, that episode, which I just watched again recently, stands out because it's such a celebration of jazz, and it was on prime time on a weeknight, and you had American audiences by the millions being introduced or reintroduced to the music that Bill Cosby loves, that is our American soundtrack, jazz.
What happens in the episode itself is that Cliff Huxtable's father, Russell, you know, it turns out he used to be a jazz musician. He's retired. He has the opportunity to play with the old band one more time, and they all have to kind of convince him to do it.
And the final member has just arrived, Slide Huxtable.
And he finally goes and does it. And the whole back third of the episode is just the show of him playing with this old band. And he's up there with some serious all-stars.
Because standing here is about 1,000 years of jazz.
Art Blakey, Jimmy Heath, Patato.
Normally we let Slide warm up. But however, there is no time because Patato and I are getting old.
Now me, baby, you run, baby.
Vamos, amigos, muchachos, a tocar, vamos.
It was truly, you know, these now when we look at it, of course, these young jazz greats. But again, that the fact that jazz would be incorporated into what was then the most popular television show is pretty extraordinary.
And the actor who plays Russell, who is the grandfather on The Cosby Show, he's up there with these people. He's like mouthing along, playing the slide trombone while the other musicians are actually playing. And then, you know, again, just the time of it is kind of amazing. You know, a sitcom is generally 22 minutes without commercials. And it's almost a full 7 minutes that is just set in the club. He just lets it play.
And of course, Daisy, we're recording our show on 125th Street in the heart of Harlem in New York City. And actually that scene, they record, or they make it seem like they recorded it, in a little jazz dive club right down the street from the Apollo Theater. I mean, what great television.
I know, it's funny watching that episode all these years later and going, it looks like they are a block away from where we are right now, and just the energy and the music itself feeling so vibrant and really coming through. And they bring the whole family. Like, they're at a club. Rudy's there. She's at the bar watching with the family. So it really is a family affair no matter what.
I love that last scene where it's kind of like everybody, all the bartenders have gotten home, and it's just Bill Cosby and his wife, Felicia Rashad, and they're just dancing quietly, and there's no rush, and it's just a jazz club on a weekday night someplace in Harlem.
Quite an evening, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was.
Russell hasn't lost his touch.
Spencer hasn't either.
Spencer's lost his endurance. He's in dreamland.
And so is Russell.
You know, and as we've said, you know, kind of being able to watch these shows and see people that you recognize, you know, seeing Tito Puente on that show, he gets a line, he's front and center with the timbales. You know, that's an amazing experience, not just for me as someone who grew up, you know, in New York City with my family, but you know, immigrants see that and they see people that are playing the music that they're familiar with, too.
It's kind of like Bill Cosby had this idea, this very kind of, I don't know, revolutionary idea, because this was happening so many decades ago, to actually be kind of like truly multi-culti on primetime.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that ends up happening is that, you know, people who, again, were seen as quote unquote minorities or the other or the outsiders, suddenly you're on prime time. And for many immigrants, it really clicked in. It really clicked because it was like, yeah, this is the American family that I want to be a part of. And it was wonderful speaking with Mr. Cosby, because it turns out that This happens to him all the time, and it happens a lot precisely from immigrants who love him.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there with the term American family. His way of talking about family is what made him so relatable to so many people. And I think that that's the reason that he is, you know, arguably an American icon at this point.
So, you know, Daisy, what I did is I actually was very intrigued about this. And so I asked Mr. Cosby what the response is that he gets from people from different backgrounds, different immigrant groups, different cultural experiences. And this is what he had to say.
The most beautiful thing for me, I get in a cab. I get in a car with a chauffeur. I get on a bus. I get at the train station. And some person working there is now a citizen of the United States, male or female. And the first thing that they say to me generally is how much they love the show. Number two, exactly what the show meant to them in terms of family. Then these cab drivers who work 14 to 16 hours a day driving all around, whether they're bad guys or nasty guys, they show me pictures of the family. And they have four or five kids, and so-and-so's going to college. This one graduated from, and these are elitist things, too. And this man, and I met maybe two women driving. They're supporting wife, family. They say family, family, family.
You love that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Because, look, your mother and father, no matter what, their revolution, whether it's civil rights or just a personal individual, is in the home. It's in the home.
You know, Daisy, the truth is that Mr. Cosby continues to give us his words of wisdom. I mean, I just love what he says about the idea of revolution being in the home. And that's so true of so many immigrant families, families who are essentially saying, we are hopeful and we want change and we want to be a part of it.
It really is remarkable how much of his work has been able to speak to so many people.
And we want to thank all of the guests who appeared throughout our program. Felix Contreras is the co-host of NPR's Alt Latino. Joe Conzo Sr. is a music historian and the author of Mambo Diablo, My Journey with Tito Puente. And Rebecca Molion is a pianist, composer, and an educator. And we thank all of them for their knowledge and for sharing it with us on Latino USA. And of course, our biggest muchas gracias goes out to Bill Cosby himself for coming and sharing his passion with us at our studios here in the heart of Harlem. Thank you, Señor Cosby. As we just learned on our music lessons on this very special Latino USA, before there was salsa, there was mambo. And before there was mambo, there was rumba. If you sat down for a martini at any hotel lounge in the 1940s in America, you'd probably hear a rumba coming from the bandstand. And the man playing it might have been Irving Fields. Irving Fields was born to a Jewish family in Brooklyn and went on to become one of the great American interpreters of the rumba. He brings us today's sabiduría, words of wisdom.
When I was about 18, 19 years old, I got a job playing on a cruise ship. I never traveled, and I was so excited. Havana, and when I got to Havana, Cuba, I was hired as a concert pianist just to play for a few concerts. I got $10 for the week, and I heard this Latin music, and I got goosebumps. The conga drum, the bongos, the clavas, the excitement of the rhythm, different sounds. I still remember every day, every moment, because it was one of the highlights of the memory of my life. Yeah, people always ask me, Gee, was are you 97? No, 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 you're not 97. Maybe 67. I says, you make me feel very, very good. He says, how do you keep so young looking? I says, well, here's my secret to longevity. Sense of humor. You'll never get ulcers. Think before you make a decision. Be the first to say hello with a smile on your face and a friendly glow. When you have an argument, everybody has an argument with your wife or business, change the subject and the argument is forgotten. Be thankful for the blessings you have, not what you don't have. Don't envy anyone. So many are worse off than you. Travel is so important to life. Be a good listener. You learn something. This is hard for me to do. Eat 4 hours before bedtime. You will digest better. I work 7 to 10, 6 nights a week at Nino's Tuscany in New York City. I get hungry at 10 o'clock. Never make a decision intoxicated. Whatever you do, don't wait till tomorrow. Do it now. Who knows what tomorrow brings?
I started out to go to Cuba.
Lessons of longevity from the great Jewish rumba pianist Irving Fields. And if you want to hear Fields tickle the ivories, head down to Nino's Tuscany on 58th Street in New York City. He's there almost every night of the week.